I should probably start by saying two things. First is that I present this talk in the hope of sparking some discussion. So I will deliberately say some things that people may find controversial, and I hope that we can have that discussion at the end. The second thing is that this can only ever be a personal viewpoint, born out of my own 20 years or so of experience of collaborative research with people in various aspects of healthcare. So to cut a very long story short, ever since my PhD, I have been working in sociology departments using conversation analysis in healthcare settings. So I've worked with all kinds of different professionals. I've worked with pharmacists, GPs, genetic counsellors, midwives, obstetricians, and so on. And I've also worked with people from all kinds of different branches of healthcare sciences, so nursing, public health, primary care, clinical medicine, and so on. And so in that sense, such as I have an academic career, my academic career has been, you might categorise it as, one long collaborative research project. And what I want to try and do today is outline two particular issues that consistently arise for me when I work in collaboration with healthcare professionals using CA. So I want to start just by saying something that you probably all already know, that collaborative research is pretty much framed as a universal positive. If you read any of the literature about collaboration, then all kinds of claims are made for it. So the idea that it exposes people to alternative research perspectives, alternative literatures, the idea that it's a means of developing new ways to address problems, and also pragmatically that it's a way of enabling researchers to do things that they couldn't do on their own. So what I want to do is start by giving an example of a project I was involved in that I think had some positive outcomes, but I then want to think a bit about why it might have brought some problems as well as some positives. So, over 4 years or so, from about 2000 to about 2004, I worked with a consultant obstetrician and a professor of midwifery in the UK. And I worked with them on a project that was born out of the implementation of the introduction of a new antenatal screening programme for fetal abnormality. So it was something that was called nuchal translucency, or NT screening. And the interest of my collaborators was in how they could improve the understanding of women about what the tests entailed and whether they should choose to undergo them or not. So the background to this research was that since antenatal screening has been widely available in the UK, which is about 25 years or so, there have been a number of social scientific studies which have suggested that women don't really feel they have a choice about undergoing these tests, and that they feel they have to have the tests that are offered to them. At the same time, though, research that's been carried out with midwives over that time period suggests that they feel that they work really hard to establish choice and to make clear that women do have a choice in these procedures, to make clear that these tests aren't compulsory. And what was quite quickly apparent from a fairly cursory glance at the literature was that there was almost no research examining the actual consultations. Almost everything that was there was interview-based. And of course, without looking at the consultations, it seemed impossible to understand how both sets of participants appeared to end up with such a different understanding of what had gone on. So we carried out a fairly standard CA study, supplemented it with some ethnographic work, to try and see what it was that women and midwives were orienting to as significant in those encounters. And what we found was that midwives almost always did explicitly and at the beginning of consultations make clear that the tests were optional. So they'd say things like, it's up to you, or you can have these tests or you cannot have these tests. But the consultations often went on for some time, and so the other thing we found was that what happened in the consultation subsequently tended to undermine this explicit construction of choice at the outset. And it tended to undermine it for three reasons. So the first issue was an issue of placement, that these optional screening tests were always discussed immediately after much more routine and unproblematic tests. So things like taking a blood sample from the mother to test for anemia. And so the placement of them directly after these very straightforward tests, which generally speaking people don't tend to refuse, tended to conflate them with those tests. The second thing we found was that midwives tended to highlight the benefits of the tests. So while they never explicitly said it would be better to test, they said things like, if there are any problems, it will enable you to find out earlier. So although they made no explicit recommendation, many women inferred from what was said that testing would be a preferable option. And the third thing we found was that, obviously this was a new screening programme, the old screening tests were also still available to women should they choose to take them. And so when we analysed the data closely, it looked in some cases as though the choice that was being presented to women seemed to be more focused on whether they would choose the old or the new test, rather than whether they would choose the new test or not test at all. So by approaching the project in this way, we could see why it was that previous research had produced such conflicting results. We could see why the apparently competing versions from women and midwives could coexist. And we could also see that although midwives did indeed make choice explicit at the outset of the encounters, by the end of them, that wasn't what women were orienting to. And so based on that, we could make some recommendations for practice. So potentially then, this study might be seen as an example of collaborative research with healthcare professionals that work quite well. But instead of taking that success at face value, I want for a minute to think about potential problems. And I've said I want to raise a couple of concerns, and in trying to conceptualise these, I think one of them is probably best conceptualised as an intellectual concern, and the other one's best conceptualised as an ethical concern. So I'll take the intellectual concern first. And if I take the intellectual one first, those of you in the room who wouldn't identify as sociologists are going to have to bear with me just for a moment, because I'm going to use sociology as an example. But I think, and this is something that we can talk about after the talk, that what I have to say would apply equally to those of us using CA who are based in other social science disciplines. So Andrew Abbott, in his book Chaos of Disciplines, calls sociology a general social science. And he says that what he means by this is that while some disciplines, and he uses the example of economics, have an accepted right way and a wrong way to conduct research, sociology doesn't. And he says as a result of that, both its scope and its responsibility are greater. And in particular, Abbott talks about an inability to keep judgments about the rightness of things separate from investigations of their actual nature. And he goes on to argue that that's both a strength and also a potential weakness, the idea that value judgments can become mixed with scientific ones. And he suggests it's a weakness because it allows and enables sociology, and by implication the research tools of sociology, to be co-opted by other disciplines for their own particular purposes. So while Abbott's writings are relatively new, what they remind me of is a much older distinction. And that's the distinction that's been made since the 1950s, so first made by somebody called Robert Strauss in 1957, between sociology of medicine and sociology in medicine. And again, I think this is a distinction that holds for other disciplines such as psychology. So Strauss's distinction is old, but this is a concept that's still got currency. So the quote that I've stuck on the slide there is from the most recent edition of the Blackwell Encyclopedia of Sociology. And so what the definition there says, I'll just read through it. It says, sociology in medicine is the label given to the collaborative work between sociologists and medical or health personnel within medical institutions or healthcare organisations. This distinction represents the applied work of medical sociologists in the pure versus applied dichotomy of the social sciences. In its most extreme form, sociology in medicine encompasses sociological work aimed at the provision of technical skills and problem solving for the medical community, while neglecting contributions to the parent discipline. So those are my italics that I've stuck on the last sentence there. But that sentence that I've italicised is the one that, in my personal view, gets right to the heart of the problem that I want to highlight. So this neglect of contributions to the parent discipline, I think, is a criticism that can quite fairly be applied to my own work, or the work that I was just talking about in relation to antenatal screening. Because that work did indeed solve a problem for the medical community, because it provided an explanation for how and why those two competing accounts coexisted. And it offered practical suggestions for how that issue might be dealt with moving forward in terms of practice. But in terms of the contributions it made to CA, more widely, and beyond that to sociology, I think it's a bit less clear cut. So you might argue that it promoted the use of CA as a method. You might argue that it shed some light on the interactions of a group of healthcare professionals, midwives, who hadn't been much studied up until that point. But beyond that, I find it quite difficult to make the case for a more substantive contribution. And I suppose one view to take on that would be, well, the research served a practical purpose, it had demonstrable impact in terms of service organisation and delivery, so maybe that lack of contribution to anything wider shouldn't matter that much. And maybe, on a case-by-case basis, it's true that it shouldn't matter very much. But I think there's a wider problem there. So the project that I talked about is, I think, a fairly classic example of collaborative work, or collaborative work within healthcare at least. And I think that work is very often problem-driven. It often comes about to explore or address very specific issues or contingencies. And that can mean that its applications are very specific. And what Abbott argues is what that means is that this kind of research doesn't create enduring self-reproducing communities. So collaborative studies are ultimately dependent on the insights of the specialised disciplines from which they draw. And so the end consequence of that is that the kind of work that I was talking about requires a strong CA, but it doesn't necessarily contribute a great deal to that strength itself. So that's the first concern that I want to raise. The second concern, and I've conceptualised this as an ethical one, and I think Charles Goodwin puts this far more eloquently than I could. So he asks the question, what happens when, as social scientists, we put our professional skills at the service of another profession and amplify its voice and the power it can enforce over those who become the objects of its scrutiny? So, in my case, the profession that I'm usually putting my professional skills at the service of is usually medicine. And I think it would be fair to say that in a UK context at least, that's not a profession that's generally thought to be lacking in power to start with. And I think for me, these ethical problems are particularly compounded by the fact that sociologists have a tendency to position themselves on the side of the angels. That there's a long tradition of sociological research that is explicitly aimed at taking the position of the underdog. But I think that one of the potential perils of collaborative research is that it's possible, maybe unintentionally, to have quite the opposite effect. And so again, I'll try and illustrate that by drawing on some work with which I've been involved. So for a number of years, I've carried out research into doctor-patient interaction, as well as other healthcare professional interaction, with a particular interest in advice giving in those settings. And increasingly, I'm invited by clinicians to discuss potential topics for collaboration or ideas for future research. And in those discussions, over the last 5 or so years at least, I've started to find that there's a very common recurring theme. So different professions will put it in different ways, but invariably it's not long before the topic of directiveness or non-directiveness, or patient autonomy, or patient-centeredness comes up. So frequently, practitioners ask me, how I can help them be less directive, or how I can help them to increase patient-centeredness in their interactions. And to set the context for these requests, I'm going to draw specifically on some work that I carried out in collaboration with Robert Dingle, who I know is sitting at the back of the room somewhere. And so, as Robert and I have previously noted, researchers have traditionally treated doctor-patient interaction as a site where doctors exercise power over patients. And that's often grounded in the work of Parsons. I think both Robert and I have some issues with that grounding, but this is probably not the place to discuss those. But the kind of idea that the resulting asymmetry is problematic has underpinned a whole raft of reforms to policy and practice. What's interesting from my point of view is that there's not a whole lot of research evidence to back that up. So systematic reviews have failed to find any convincing evidence. There are some more recent studies that find negative effects, particularly in terms of health outcomes, or certainly no effect at all. So this position seems to rest more squarely on a moral assumption than it does on research evidence. So the clinical evidence that patients do better from patient-centered medicine is pretty mixed. If we turn to the sociological evidence that underpins this power-based analysis, then Sharrock, who expresses a view that I share, says, well, that kind of analysis that focuses on power acts as indictment rather than inquiry. So a description of a medical encounter as oppressive is only ever going to be blame-finding. It's only ever going to produce a reading of a medical encounter where you see patients as stifled or closed down in some kind of way. And Shegloff expresses the case a bit more generally, and again, this is probably a quote that's familiar to many of you in the room. So talking about this kind of critical analysis that's focused on power, that stipulates the a priori existence of relevance of power and status, he says, however well informed and well disposed towards the participants, and indeed often enough the whole rationale of the critical stance is the championing of what are taken to be authentic indigenous perspectives, there's a kind of theoretical imperialism involved here, a kind of hegemony of the intellectuals. This theoretical apparatus gets to stipulate the terms by reference to which the world is to be understood, when there has already been a set of terms by which the world was understood by those endogenously involved in its very coming to pass. So Shegloff concludes with the fairly unforgiving comparison of this kind of critical analysis to those who talk about Columbus discovering America, as if indigenous people weren't already living there. And so the implication is that researchers can be prone to see their research as revealing or uncovering features of everyday life, as if ordinary people weren't already managing it perfectly well for themselves. And so it follows for Shegloff, and he's talking about sociology here, but he's also referring to that to mean CA specifically, it follows for Shegloff that the task isn't to privilege sociology's concerns under the rubric social structure, but to discover them in the members' worlds, if indeed they're there to be found, and maybe they won't be. So, that probably doesn't tell any of you in the room anything that you don't know, given the interest in CA in this room. You're probably all mostly also aware that CA research into doctor-patient interaction suggests three things. So, it suggests that patients do defer to doctors. It suggests that they do so actively, so for example by withholding their own assessments of things. And it suggests that they do so for good reason, because they share with doctors the locally functional goal of diagnosis and treatment. So, simply speaking, patients recognise that in choosing to put their problem in the hands of a doctor, some level of deferral is likely to be the most efficient strategy for achieving their goal, for getting what they need from that encounter. So asymmetry then is demonstrably co-constructed. So again, so far so good. But the problem begins for me because building on those findings, Some CA researchers have suggested that CA is uniquely placed to assist with the development of more patient-centred medicine. As this quote from the review by Maynard and Heritage suggests, so the idea that analysing co-construction is a direct research embodiment of patient-centeredness. It facilitates the biopsychosocial approach to the interview, as well as a more recent emphasis on relationship-centred care. So the implication that I take from this is that CA can be used as a kind of tool to achieve patient-centeredness. But the problem that I think both Robert and I have with this is that such a suggestion rests on an uncritical acceptance that patient-centeredness is the way forward for medical practice. So it accepts the medical agenda wholesale, and it co-opts CA as a kind of tool to bring that about. But as we've already seen, the evidence for the effectiveness of patient-centeredness in clinical terms is pretty mixed. And what I find repeatedly in my own data, in my own empirical research, across a variety of healthcare settings, is that it also raises very difficult interactional issues. So for example, what doctors see as patient-centeredness, or what healthcare professionals more widely see as patient-centeredness, and the way in which they promote the autonomy which is seen to go along with this, may well be oriented to by patients as an unwanted burden. So I've got two very brief examples that I'm just going to talk to. I've not brought the sound for them, I'm just going to talk through them on the slides, just to try and give you some kind of indication of what I mean about the way in which this occurs practically. So the example on the slide there comes from a project I'm currently working on with a colleague, Olga Zeitz, looking at antenatal screening consultations in public hospitals in Hong Kong. And this extract comes after the nurse, who's N in the transcript, has delivered information to the pregnant woman about available screening options. And then the nurse begins to inquire about a decision. So the nurse says, "Or can you decide today? Or you prefer to talk to your husband first?" The woman says, "It's okay, which is the best for me? Don't know." Nurse says, "Nah, see, nah. See, now whether you want to have the first thing is you decide whether you want to have test or no test, okay? And the second thing is whether you want to have direct test or indirect test, whether you want to have an accurate test or whether you want to have a safe test. If you want to have a safe test, then you need to undergo the screening test. But if you think that I want to have an accurate test, then you need to undergo the other test." There's a 10-second pause while the woman looks at the papers that are laid out in front of the nurse that have her numerical results on them. And then she gives what I can best describe as a kind of wry chuckle. And indeed, there is no decision forthcoming at this point. So if we look at this a little bit, the woman's question in line 3 here suggests that her difficulty with the decision relates to not knowing what would be the best decision in her particular circumstances, rather than not understanding the information that she's already been given. But the nurse responds to the request indirectly by summarising at some length the information about available choices that she's already delivered. She also makes very clear that the decision lies with the woman. But as I've said, this repetition of information doesn't lead to the woman's decision. And for me, what this consultation brings to mind is Charles Bosk's vivid metaphor that the dark side of patient autonomy is patient abandonment. So it's very clear here that the woman is given the autonomy to make her own decision. What I think is far less clear is whether that autonomy is helpful or desirable to her. So the second example I've got is taken from some older data, some work on genetic counselling for familial hereditary disorders. And practitioners here are particularly concerned with non-directiveness as a component of what they see as patient-centred counselling. And the context for this extract is that a client with myotonic dystrophy has just reported to the clinical geneticist his mother's view that his condition might better be managed through diet than medication. So the councillor responds to this suggestion by saying, I mean, it's because I'm of your mum's generation, so I have to be careful what I say. The client says, yeah, but you're a learned man. You know more about it. She just doesn't. I mean, and the councillor says, well, people like me too would like to have an explanation that suits us. So, again, what's interesting for me in this extract is that it's notable that the geneticist avoids explicitly contradicting the view of the client's mother. And in fact, when the client himself attempts to make a distinction between the two different sets of advice that he's been given, based on the fact that the geneticist is a learned man, while his mother has no specialist knowledge, the geneticist himself aligns with the mother by suggesting that they both share a desire for explanation. So in this particular instance, the desire to be non-directive over the issue of diet appears to result in a disavowal of the clinical geneticist possessing any greater expertise than the client's mother does. So those two brief examples, I hope, give a snapshot of some of the consequences that a commitment to patient-centred or non-directive practice creates in some of the settings in which I'm working. And I hope it's suggested to you that at the very least, it may not be of unproblematic benefit to patients. As I said at the beginning, it's often what my collaborators tell me what they would like to achieve. So from their point of view, patient-centeredness, non-directiveness is the success that they're looking for. And CA researchers might well feel that they have the tools to bring this about. But it's not clear that patients share that goal, and it's not clear to me that CA might not better be positioned as an objective observer of medical practice. Because if patients accept, or maybe even prefer, the presence of asymmetry in healthcare consultations, then why should we be co-opted into achieving these reforms? And if research consistently finds embedded asymmetry, well then maybe the research task is better conceptualised with a focus on whether and what purpose that kind of functional asymmetry might serve, rather than a wholesale alignment with the medical reformer's goal of trying to get rid of it, trying to make it go away in some kind of way. And so I entirely accept that ultimately that might result in less radical reform, but I also think it would be reform that's grounded in empirical evidence rather than co-option into a reform agenda that's been identified by the medical profession. And I suppose the further extension of that line of thought is that it's not appropriate to present any method, but for these purposes CA, as a kind of magic bullet to bring about reform, as opposed to a means of trying to understand the nature of the institution that's being studied. And I think that latter point's got particular relevance for collaborative research in healthcare, given the fact that it's so often targeted at the resolution of a specific problem. So, just to try and sum up a bit, I'm aware that I've been all over the place in this presentation, that I've covered quite a lot of ground. Given the dangers of co-option that I've talked about and the ethical implications that can follow, I'd suggest that for research in healthcare settings to be truly collaborative, it's of fundamental importance that CA researchers are not just the people who turn up with the armoury of tools when the plans have already been drawn up. So, to put it another way, and to finally get to the third part of the three-part list in my title, I don't want to be the equivalent of a research plumber who just turns up with the CA toolkit to patch over the leak in the interaction. For me, properly collaborative research even, between CA researchers and clinicians, needs involvement at all stages. And that begins with the formulation of the research question and goes then through the data collection and the analysis. And I think that's necessary for two reasons. So firstly, it's necessary in terms of the strength or success of the output to avoid that stinging comparison that Shegloff makes about discovery in America. But secondly, I think an involvement in the conceptualisation of projects helps to ensure a more successful focus, not just on what CA might bring to an endeavour, but also how CA itself might develop as a result. So I think it's only by approaching things in that way that you can help to guarantee that research that's carried out also contributes to CA's ongoing health, as well as providing the answers that those in other disciplines might seek. And I shall stop now, because I think I've started enough arguments.
Thank you. All right, good. Plenty of time then for all kinds of observations. Yes, Ron.
With the comparative analysis happening in production as far as written about them, would be an approach.
Sorry, I can't quite hear you.
So, would going comparative beyond particular institutions and what others have written about is a way, could be a way for to fit in to CA from particular settings?
Yeah, and I think that's certainly, you know, it is one way in demonstrating that something has much broader relevance by comparing it, you know, by comparing an activity type across different settings. So, yeah.
Yes, Julie.
Yeah, I just want to speak up on behalf of plumbers, actually. Several of whom, I have several good friends who are plumbers, and they get really pissed off with being called in to fix the mess that people earlier on have put in place. Mm-hmm. So I just want to say that about, you know, plumbing. And the other thing I wanted to say is that there are times, very limited times, when FUCO is actually quite useful. But you've got to keep him within, you know, within bounds. But where you're obviously working with a professional discourse of co-option and internalisation and ownership as part of health improvements. And what Foucault is brilliant at is enabling us to see what happens when a piece of a discourse breaks loose and goes to other places where it's not welcome. Mm. And where, when it gets inside other places, it does a lot of damage. Mm. And I think that's just a useful way of thinking about how that kind of totalitizing set of ideas begins to inform other sorts of practices where it's no use.
And I think that's certainly true of the way in which counselling discourse has colonised all kinds of spheres of practice that it wasn't originally intended for, and where it doesn't necessarily work terribly well on a practical basis.
Yes, Fiona.
It reminds me, what you're saying actually reminds me quite a lot about the arguments that statisticians are having. So I
don't do numbers, Fiona.
No, I know, but that's what's interesting for me, because I don't know numbers and I'm very well known for it in my department by numbers. But it's what you said at the end is very much what they say, the second point actually, that if you really want to have a reasonable piece of work, and they again talk about the clinicians, then you need to involve the statistician from the very beginning. That this idea about that Jesus talked about, you know, coming in at the end and patching over, they argue that quite strongly. So in terms of practically making this happen, I think that in certain settings there may actually be an opportunity for this, because I think you can go in and say, actually, I can't come in at the end and just fix this as a problem. So it's very, and it's what they've been saying. So in some ways there is a discourse around that going on from other people.
Mm-hmm.
I work in a department where we've got people who do epidemiology, where they're important, but that's what I think. And I think it is a useful way of thinking about it. And it also reminds me a little bit about about how you manage it. So the work that Vasiliki and I do about decision making in A&E sort of came from the idea that this clinician had this interest in, he wanted to use psychological measures about why, he thought it was like psychologically, kind of personality type about why people can't make decisions.
Mm.
And so I sort of said to him, well, actually, is it really about that? But we would be interested in doing some research about understanding how decisions are constructed. And so the agreement sort of came along, if you can get some money to do it, we'll let you in. So it's an interesting kind of way of doing it. It's sort of what it reminded me of.
Mm.
I would enjoy that.
I mean, I think it is always a really tricky negotiation, given the particular position that medicine occupies in a UK context, but in many other national contexts also. And I think that we create the problem for ourselves sometimes, because inevitably when we try and encourage healthcare scientists of all kinds of different stripes to be involved in collaborative research, we tend to point them to the CA papers that have the nice problem-oriented problem-solving findings, because those are the ones they can get their head around and see, okay, yes, you know, you can do this, and you know, this method, I can see it works in this kind of way. But in a sense, that perpetuates the idea that they then think that that's what you can come in and do, you know, kind of and clear up after yourself and go away and leave them all nicely patient-centred. So I don't suggest it's an easy problem to overcome, and really it was something that, you know, I kind of wanted to put out there for discussion rather than suggest I had all the answers to it. I suspect it's probably easier for statisticians to metaphorically throw their weight around in terms
practical, isn't it? We're talking about doing something conceptual.
Yes.
But also it is about funding, which is the real issue, because actually, I work within a medical school, and if you want to survive, then that's what they say, and you have to play that game. But it makes me uncomfortable, you said, but because I really agree with you.
But I think, you end up in a bind, because funders like problem-oriented research. The way in which the REF has been operationalised does not particularly like problem-oriented research, and how we strike that balance is a whole other set of questions and debates.
Robert.
Just to sort of one is, and I think the evidence of this room is kind of quite interesting about the prodigious contribution of problem-oriented work most material basis in it. And that I think is, you know, it's a sort of distinctive thing about probably more conversation about system methodology, the way in which it's not quite owned by a variety of academic disciplines. And as a result, it kind of exists on the margins of subsistence between sociology, psychology, communications, and linguistics, without being kind of core to any of them, and in a place where it can really resource the development of fundamental work in the way that other areas of each of those disciplines can do so. We may, in the four walls of this room, talk about it as being a scam. But let's not forget, it's a scam that creates a lot of jobs and a lot of investment. The other thing which I did want to contribute, perhaps, though, is the way in which the questions that Alison's asking kind of join up with the sort of emerging agenda, particularly which Heritage has been pushing, about epistemics. The extent to which you do get the conversation between CIA and ethno methodology, and these sort of recent issues about what constitutes knowledge, what constitutes rights in knowledge, the kinds of parallel discussions in science and technology studies, there's I think quite a lot of work to be done. It's a kind of paradox. You talk about a couple of times about it doesn't quite join up. What he's saying about the reform agenda in CA, and what he's writing in this really brilliant series of papers about epistemics. But what we have here, I think, is something where, there is this sort of fundamental problem about knowledge, about asymmetries of knowledge, and about where are asymmetries of knowledge functional and dysfunctional, which I think some of the third wave debate in science and technology studies has got a bit further with. In terms of saying, actually, some people do know more than others, and it's appropriate to defer to that knowledge. What you can't then do is to sort of take that as a kind of generalised expertise that, just because Brian Cox is a scientist does not mean making an authority on evolution. If anybody saw his programmes on evolution, they are absolute rubbish. You may be great on cosmology. And it may be appropriate to defer to what he says in cosmology. It's not appropriate to invoke this sort of fundamental. I think medicine is arguably the same.
I think I agree entirely that the fact that CA is perhaps described as slightly marginal to several disciplines rather than sitting wholesale in one creates a particular range of problems. because it creates the kind of problems that Abbott talks about in terms of kind of how long can it live off itself, but it also creates the problems of how do you then feed back from CA into those disciplines which it borders. And I mean, I certainly don't mean to pass judgment on problem-oriented research. I mean, one of the reasons that I choose my own examples as the means for slagging off this as an endeavour is because I have been as entirely guilty of it as anybody else, you know, sometimes for reasons of pragmatics and funding, sometimes because I didn't think carefully enough about what it was that I was doing before I embarked on it. So it's not that I imagine that I know something other people don't. It's more, I think, that it's an issue that we don't talk about as much as we should.
Last question from Ruth.
I disagree a bit with some of the things that you said.
Good.
Which I know you would like. the people who come to me don't come to me wanting, sorry, the clinical people coming to me and wanting to work with me don't come to me wanting to be more patient-centred or equal. They come because there's an area, there's something that's a problem, and usually because they know some people are handling it better than other people.
Mm-hmm.
But they are unable to articulate that. And I think then, as conversation analysts, the problem solving that we're doing, in a way, fits very nicely with some of the things that Shegnev was saying, is often that we're not solving the problems ourselves, we're trying to identify some practitioners who do solve those problems or get their ways around them and then feed that back to people.
Mm-hmm.
So I feel comfortable in doing that, and I think, you know, you nearly always will in a data set find some natty things that some people have developed. So I don't feel so uncomfortable and troubled by it as you do. And also I would say it's really, yeah, that's not the impression I get from people. In fact, quite the reverse. This idea of making things more symmetrical, what I've found, certainly in feeding back to people, is they know they're not symmetrical, they know they can't be, they feel bloody guilty because they can't do these things they're being told to do, and they know they don't do them.
Mm.
And when you explain it, they love you, which is quite like. And so, you know, and that seems fine, and it enables people to then, on the ground, to then challenge these things.
Mm.
So again, I feel more optimistic than you do about that.
I mean, I wouldn't say that I'm unoptimistic. I think that the way in which things are more often presented to me is that actually what is at issue is not patient-centeredness. It's some kind of different interactional phenomenon. I don't even know if you can describe patient-centeredness as an interactional phenomenon.
Mm.
But it's something else entirely, like giving explanations that are too technically complex.
Mm.
But because the agenda of patient-centeredness is so much out there, and because people are told that it's what they have to do, practitioners imagine that by being patient-centred, whatever that means in practice, it will solve all the other interactional components of things that they're finding problematic. So in a sense, in my experience, it can mask the kind of things that you're talking about, that, you know, where you can draw resources out from more able communicative members for that particular purpose of your team and share those with other people. Because in practitioners' heads is this notion that patient-centred practice, as defined vaguely in various sets of literature, is the gold standard that they're trying to aim for.
Mm.
More argument with Alison over lunch, but once again, thank you very much. Okay, lunch break.